Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now, find out more about the exhibition at PEM.org. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Big election results in Kentucky, Mississippi, and Virginia. We will take a look later this hour at what yesterday's gubernatorial and legislative races say about what might happen in 2020. But first, it is only Wednesday, and it's already been another significant week in the impeachment inquiry. And joining us now with the latest is Nancy Cordes, chief congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
So first of all, today we see that the number three person in the State Department has shown up to testify. Tell us more about that.
Right. He's one of the only witnesses who is actually appearing this week. Most of the others have been no-shows. He's the Undersecretary of State, as you said, the number three in the State Department. So he would have been privy to some very sensitive conversations with the Secretary of State about this controversy. And according to the Associated Press, he is telling congressional investigators behind closed doors that the Secretary of State and other senior officials, when they were urged to defend the U.S. ambassador, Marie Yovanovitch, who was suddenly yanked out of Ukraine because Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal attorney, viewed her as an impediment to getting Ukraine to conduct these investigations into the Biden family, that when she was suddenly recalled and it was having an impact on morale at the State Department, they talked about whether to issue some sort of statement of support for her, but ultimately decided that it would hurt the effort to free up U.S. military aid to Ukraine. In other words, because it was the president who had withheld this military aid in what several witnesses have said was a quid pro quo to push Ukraine to announce these investigations that would help the president politically, that they thought that announcing support for her would damage their efforts to try to change the president's mind and get this aid flowing again, even without those promises from the Ukrainians to investigate. And so the Democrats will have a lot of questions for Hale about who exactly was in those conversations, what was said. Mm-hmm. Did the Secretary of State himself understand that there was a quid pro quo? And all of this, of course, coming after we learned that Gordon Sondland, the right. U.S. ambassador to the EU, has changed his testimony.
So I was just going to ask you about that. So David Hale showing up today, again, the number three person in the State Department. And as you pointed out, Nancy, the first this week, because the White House, the Trump administration had basically said it was going to follow a zero cooperation strategy. Mm-hmm. Seeing Hale show up to testify was kind of eye opening. Do you right. think it's because of Gordon Sondland, Ambassador Sondland's revised testimony? Is that what we ought to call it?
I don't know if the two are connected. I do know that Hale is someone who has served his career at the State Department, so he's not necessarily someone who is as closely linked to President Trump himself as, say, Rick Perry, the Secretary of Energy, who said that he's not going to be showing up tomorrow, or Mick Mulvaney, the President's Chief of Staff, who we're told is probably not going to show up on Friday. And so he signaled a couple of days ago that he would be testifying. But yes, that Sondland addendum to his previous testimony was pretty eye-opening. He essentially submitted this three-page document to Congress on Monday saying that he does now recall, his memory has been jogged, mm-hmm. and he does now recall that he himself delivered a message to a top Ukrainian official saying, your aid is not going to be reinstated until you announce these anti-corruption investigations, which was kind of code for announce an investigation into Burisma, the energy company in Ukraine that had Hunter Biden, the Vice President Biden's son, as a sitting on its board. And so the fact that Sondland did that was kind of a sign that even some of these loyalists to the president, and remember that Gordon Sondland was not a career diplomat. Mm-hmm. He's somebody who was a very successful hotel magnate. He donated $1 million to the president's inaugural committee, and that's part of the reason he was named U.S. ambassador to the European Union. So he was someone who was who owed this particular role to the president, trying to get the president's message across in Ukraine. And even he is now saying, after multiple witnesses disputed his original testimony, that he does now recall this quid pro quo.
Right. So just to underscore the importance of this, right, in this 4-page sworn statement that he submitted, it directly contradicts the earlier testimony, right, that he gave to investigators, House investigators last month, where at that time he said he never thought there was any precondition on that Ukrainian aid.
Originally, he sort of proclaimed ignorance. He said, I didn't even realize what the connection was between Biden and Burisma until very late in the process. He sort of portrayed himself as someone who was kind of out of the loop and didn't really understand exactly what was going on. But then you had witness after witness after witness coming in and testifying, actually, that Sondland was the one delivering the president's message in some of these meetings. And he was even told point blank that he needed to stop by other top administration officials. And so it was clear that he needed to do something. And what was so interesting is that a lot of Democrats really held their fire. You had one or two who said, it looks like he's committed perjury. But by and large, most Democrats congratulated him after he changed his testimony. And that was strategic because they don't want to do anything that is going to discourage other individuals from testifying. They don't want people to be afraid that if you come in and testify and you say something that is wrong or untrue, that you might be charged with perjury. They want people to come in and sit down. And so they sort of handled him with kid gloves. And now they're all patting him on the back for coming in and changing his testimony.
But to be clear, though, Nancy, aren't Republican members of Congress looking perhaps to Kurt Volker's testimony, though, and saying that Volker didn't say that there's any explicit quid pro quo here. Is that right?
That's what they are trying to do. But keep in mind that until yesterday, they were all pointing to Sondland's testimony. And they kept telling us, look at Sondland. Look at what he said. He said no quid pro quo. Well, now that Sondland is saying there was a quid pro quo, now they're saying, oh, Sondland wasn't really involved. He was more peripheral. You have to look at Kurt Volker. And I asked Jim Jordan, who's been one of the president's fiercest defenders, just today. Well, wait a minute. Kurt Volker didn't explicitly say there was a quid pro quo, but he certainly acknowledged this back and forth that they were having with Ukrainian officials trying to get them to announce these investigations into Biden and Burisma. And furthermore, you have half a dozen other diplomats who did explicitly say that there was a quid pro quo. Why do you believe him and not all these other diplomats? And he said, well, you know, Volker is very respected and he's been doing this a long time. And I said, well, everyone, all these other diplomats have the same profile. They're also very experienced and highly respected. And he didn't really have an answer for that. But, you know, at the moment, what Republicans seem to be hanging their hat on is the fact that Volker, one out of the more than a dozen witnesses that we've seen so far, didn't explicitly believe there was a quid pro quo. And number two, the fact that in the president's conversation with the Ukrainian president, that he didn't explicitly say, here's my quid pro quo, you know, which is sort of a shaky defense. Most people, you know, if they're about to do something inappropriate, don't say, OK, well, here we go.
Right.
I'm going to bribe you now. And here's the bribe. Mm. That's at least the argument that Democrats are making. They say this is bigger than one phone call.
But regarding what Ambassador Sondland has just recently said or submitted to Congress, I mean, things are moving rather quickly here. But I'm just seeing now that Fiona Hill, the top White House Russia advisor, is taking exception to some of the things that Sondland is saying. What do we know about that?
Right. So Fiona Hill, you'll recall, was the president's top advisor on Russian affairs. She was, steeped in Russia policy. She left over the summer just before the president's phone call. And her, she's been publicly pretty quiet, although she was very willing to go in and testify. But her lawyer tweeted this morning that Sondland had fabricated his communications with Dr. Hill, none of which were over coffee. So apparently Sondland, in his 400 pages of testimony, which were released yesterday, he said that they had a conversation over coffee. Hill is saying that was not the case. And her lawyer goes on to say that Dr. Hill told Sondland what she told lawmakers, that the lack of coordination on Ukraine was disastrous and the circumstances of the dismissal of Ambassador Yovanovitch shameful. So clearly, Hill taking issue with one of the assertions in Sondland's testimony that was released yesterday. Her testimony has not been publicly released yet, but this really follows a pattern of multiple witnesses saying that various things that Sondland claimed in his testimony were untrue.
Okay, so that's sort of the latest in terms of what we know regarding testimony going on in the House impeachment inquiry. Tell us a little bit, Senator Mitch McConnell has been talking about, what might take place in the Senate if an impeachment trial ever reaches there. What has he been saying?
Well, he has tried in recent weeks to really steer clear of the substance of these allegations. He has had numerous opportunities to bolster the president's case. He hasn't really taken those opportunities. He says that it looks like this is all going to be coming the Senate's way eventually, so he's not going to weigh in on every twist and turn. But he is happy to weigh in on the process. He argues that the process taking place in the House is still unfair. And he said, interestingly, this week that while it does appear that the president is likely to get impeached in the House and that this will all come down to a trial in the Senate, that he doesn't see anything in these accusations right now that he believes would lead to the removal of the president. And basically what he's saying is that he doesn't think that these accusations are serious enough to cause Republicans in the Senate to side with Democrats in favor of removing the president. It's not the same as him saying that he himself doesn't believe there's anything wrong with what the president did. He's just saying he doesn't think that Republicans are going to go along with Democrats and actually vote to remove the president from office.
Well, Nancy Cordes, chief congressional correspondent for CBS News, on behalf of our listeners in Hawaii, let me tell you, aloha.
Aloha. Mahalo to you for having me on.
Hats off to you from listeners from your home state. Nancy Cordes, again, chief congressional correspondent for CBS News. We've got to take a quick break. When we come back, we will take a look at what all of this Washington politics and the impact it's having on state and local elections. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Look, the late House Speaker Tip O'Neill has probably been spinning in his grave for a while now. The idea that all politics is local has that quaint feel of yesteryear. But when voters do step into the booth, especially in a non-presidential election year, when they make decisions about their state's governors and legislators, usually that choice is supposed to be about local taxes, about schools, small businesses. But have we fully crossed over into a world now where every local election is, in part at least, a referendum on Washington? Well, three major elections yesterday in Kentucky, Mississippi, and Virginia provide perfect test cases. So let's talk about them. And we want to hear from you, especially if you're in those states. How did you decide who to vote for? Do Washington politics make any difference when you're picking your local leaders? Should it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And let's first start off in Kentucky with that big governor's race. And joining us from Louisville is Philip Bailey, political reporter for the Louisville Courier-Journal. Hello, Philip.
How are you doing there?
I'm doing very well here. So the governor's race in Kentucky, Democrat Andy Beshear is declaring victory. By how much did he win this race?
Attorney General Beshear, who is the Attorney General and the son of former Governor Steve Beshear, Governor-elect Beshear, he won yesterday's general election by about 5,150 votes, right? A very razor-thin margin, one that folks were paying attention to until the wee hours here in Kentucky. After Beshear took the stage and declared victory, Governor Matt Bevin, the Republican incumbent, said basically, "I'm not conceding," to big roars to his crowd. These two have been bitter rivals really since 2015 when both of them entered their respective offices. Governor Bevin has taken many pot shots at Andy Beshear and his father, former Governor Steve Beshear, saying that their family is corrupt, etc. But it was a very, very close election and one in which Governor Bevin mentioned irregularities but did not specify what exactly he was talking about. He sort of said it in passing during his campaign or during his election night speech, but didn't really specify.
Hmm. Well, let's listen to a moment from Governor Bevin's speech last night. Again, not a concession yet. And here's what he said.
This is a close, close race. We are not conceding this race by any stretch. Not a chance. And here's the thing. Understand this. We want the process to be followed, and there is a process. We know for a fact that there have been more than a few irregularities. They are very well corroborated, and that's all right. What they are exactly, how many, which ones, and what effect, if any, they have, will be determined according to law that's well established.
Okay, so that's Governor Matt Bevin of Kentucky not conceding last night in a very narrow race between him and possible governor-elect Andy Beshear. But Philip Bailey, look, everyone around the country is wondering, how do we read this race here, right? Because Governor Bevin was extremely unpopular. Right. President Trump visited Kentucky this week to try and help, you know, pull Bevin up. Should we read anything about the effect of Washington politics on this race, or was it still really sort of local Kentucky issues and this particular governor that that people voted on?
Governor Bevin tried mightily over the summer to define this race on national issues, on abortion, on illegal immigration, on President Trump. He did a press conference outside the governor's mansion where he implored the media, basically lectured and instructed the media to ask Andy Beshear where he stands on impeachment, understanding that President Trump's popularity levels far outpace his own. Governor Bevin was in about a negative 3% approval in the last polling that was done, bounced back from what it was. I believe Governor Bevin's campaign learned very early on in the primary when little-known freshman legislator by the name of Robert Goforth got about 40% of the vote and really cleaned Bevin's clock, particularly in parts of eastern Kentucky. And Goforth did not run a race saying he was more conservative than Governor Bevin, more liberal or moderate than Governor Bevin. No real big policy difference. Goforth's campaign was centered on Matt Bevin isn't one of us. He's a New Hampshire native. He's this New England guy. He's very brash. He's sort of this bull in a china shop. He doesn't represent our Kentucky values. As one Goforth supporter mentioned to me, Matt Bevin isn't the type of person you would invite into Meemaw's house for potato salad.
Mm.
And Andy Beshear took advantage of that. He often referred to Governor Bevin as a bully, saying he had erratic behavior. So Beshear kept the focus on health care, education, local issues that he said Kentuckians cared more about, particularly with teachers who were very, very upset with Governor Matt Bevin. I would say even some of them hate Governor Bevin, who were a big part of the Beshear campaign. So, no, I don't think you can use this race as an example for anything nationally or even in the other races. Every Republican won their statewide elections for attorney general, treasurer, secretary of state, etc. They all won, except for Matt Bevin, who has quarreled with just about every person, including the women's basketball coach at the University of Louisville, since he's taken office, including the first House Speaker, the first Republican House Speaker in about 100 years. He had a fractured relationship with his lieutenant governor, Jeanine Hampton, who he had a budding friendship with up until about 6 or 7 months ago when he dumped her from the ticket for a state senator. So Governor Bevin often thumbed his nose at traditional political norms. He wouldn't release his tax returns. He thumbed his nose at the media, at the judiciary, calling Kentucky judges hacks for ruling against him. And in many ways, that was, you know, caught fire in 2015, way before Donald Trump was elected, and got him compared to President Trump often. But I think thumbing his nose at those political norms finally caught up with him.
Wow, it didn't work for him this time around. Interesting. We've got a comment coming in on our website from Matt L. He says, as a born and raised Kentuckian, Matt says this, that it shows that President Trump's endorsement cannot resurrect the dead, Matt says. Bevin didn't need a little push from Trump. He needed a life preserver. And then Matt says, even if Beshear, a Democrat, wins the governor's mansion, the attorney general and secretary positions just flipped to Republican, a Beshear victory would still be a mixed bag for Democrats in Kentucky. So, Philip, hang on here for just a second, because I want to hop over to Mississippi, where there was another really interesting gubernatorial race. A Republican held on to the governor's seat in Mississippi. Governor-elect Tate Reeves spoke to supporters after his defeat of Attorney General Jim Hood. He won the gubernatorial race by about 50,000 votes yesterday.
It has been a long road, but it has been a good road. And I want you to know that I understand that this victory does not belong to me. This victory belongs to you. You got us through the primary, you got us through the runoff, and you got us through the toughest general election in the last 28 years in Mississippi.
That's Tate Reeves speaking last night to supporters after defeating Attorney General Jim Hood in the Mississippi gubernatorial race. And joining us now from Jackson, Mississippi, is Emily Wagster Pettis. She is a political reporter for the Associated Press in Mississippi. Emily, it's great to have you.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So the GOP really cemented its dominance, its control over Mississippi politics yesterday, did it not?
Yes, it did. Jim Hood was the last Democrat remaining in statewide office for the past dozen years. And so after last night, Republicans will actually hold all 8 of the statewide offices because they picked up the attorney general seat.
So they will hold all 8 of statewide offices. I've been hearing that that's since the first time since Reconstruction that's happened in Mississippi.
Yes, that's correct.
OK, so historic. So tell us then about what Reeves's victory in the governor's race tells us about Mississippi politics right now.
Tate Reeves really cast this election as a referendum on national politics. He constantly portrayed Jim Hood as a sort of wild-eyed liberal who was beholden to Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and other national figures, people Jim Hood has probably never honestly even met. Tate Reeves did bring President Trump and Vice President Pence to Mississippi in the closing days of the campaign. They both did appearances for him. Jim Hood basically kept his distance from most national Democratic figures until the very last day when former President Obama did a robocall that went out to voters in parts of the state on Monday, and he urged people to get out and vote for Jim Hood.
Interesting. So Reeves made this about national issues, but from your sense about, you know, Mississippi politics and Mississippi voters, would it have made a difference? I mean, if the GOP was headed down the path of cementing its control over statewide offices, did it even need to make it about national issues?
You know, that's a really good question. I mean, Jim Hood tried to cast this race as being about the issues of education, highways, infrastructure, and expansion of Medicaid. He criticized Tate Reeves on all three fronts, saying that basically under the past 8 years with Tate Reeves as lieutenant governor, that these things have been underfunded and that Mississippi has lost $1 billion a year for not expanding Medicaid. Tate Reeves, you know, did respond that he thought that expanding Medicaid was a bad idea because he thinks the state cannot afford it, and he does not want to add more people to a government program. He had responses on these issues, but he, again, would continuously steer it back to being more of a national referendum.
Interesting. Okay, well, Emily Wagster Pettis, Mississippi political reporter for the Associated Press, with us from Jackson. Emily, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay, so we've talked about Kentucky, and we'll come back to Kentucky in a minute with a narrowed possible Democratic win in the governor's office there. We talked about the GOP cementing its control over Mississippi politics. We've got the opposite story happening in Virginia. So joining us now from Harrisonburg, Virginia, is Kara Ongwili, Associate Director at the James Madison Center for Civic Engagement at James Madison University. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna. Thank you for having me.
So tell us about what happened in the election yesterday regarding the Virginia legislature.
So the Virginia legislature is now controlled by Democrats and means that Democrats now hold the governorship, the Senate, and the House of Delegates for the first time since 1993.
Since 1993. So quite a sea change there.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, no, but go ahead, because so let's first of all, national Democrats are looking at Virginia, and I suppose they're feeling exactly what national Republicans feel when they look at Mississippi, right? That there's this sort of statewide control here. Let's listen to a little bit from one of yesterday's winners in Virginia. This is Ghazala Hashmi, the first Muslim woman elected to the Virginia State Senate, speaking to supporters after she won the 10th District Senate seat.
Oh my gosh, this is overwhelming. Isn't it a great night to be a Democrat? We did it, Virginia. We did it.
So tell us, what could happen now that that Democrats are controlling the Virginia legislature?
So I think a couple of key issues that are going to come up is, first, the Equal Rights Amendment. It becomes possible for Virginia to become the 38th state needed to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment that had narrowly failed last year in the Legislative Assembly. There's also talk of continued reforms to Medicaid expansion. And there's also concerns in the state with regards to gun legislation, and particularly following the incidences over the summer in Virginia Beach. And so the Democrats, I think, are likely to focus on gun control legislation.
What has been pushing Virginia in this direction, right? Because as you said, it was, what, 10, 12 years ago that there were two Republican senators from Virginia, that the GOP had a much stronger presence in the state politically.
I think traditionally, if you look at the state of Virginia, it tends to go opposite of control of the White House. it will take a time to realign. So just eventually it will, you know, trickle down to the legislature level, to the governorship and then the legislature. I think there's some key points to be made here. We're talking about really the local politics and the local issues. And one other issue I should mention in Virginia is minimum wage laws may now be taken up in this General Assembly as well. And I should also note that the Republicans are saying that they are going to push back or hold account, that they'll work where possible with Democrats, but they will also push back if they think that Democrats are pushing too much on any of these issues. So there are some divisions. I think what's really important to note is that, you know, we do have these local institutions, but as we've heard in these other states, our politics has become nationalized. And so we saw candidates, you know, kind of campaigning on some of these broader issues that do affect people all over the country. But, you know, I've heard from candidates, for example, yesterday, you know, in their experiences of talking with voters, that, you know, it was less necessarily to do with, you know, the president, although there's research to show that presidential approval ratings do matter for how people vote in these local elections. But a lot of people are really concerned about the issues that they're facing with regards to jobs, with regards to healthcare, and with regards to education especially. And so we're seeing that really play out in the election results here. And there's also, of course, a lot of gender-based issues. I think another thing to note is the turnout differences across these three states. You know, Kentucky and Virginia turnout increased in both of those states from 2015, whereas in Mississippi, turnout was relatively the same to the gubernatorial election. So we saw a greater mobilization of voters, you know, I think around some of these issues that really matter in people's lives at the local level.
Okay, so let's turn back to Philip Bailey, who has been waiting patiently there, political reporter for the Louisville Courier-Journal in Kentucky. Philip, do you have a response to what you've been hearing Kara saying?
Right. No, I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, in 2015, we saw a turnout here in the state when Matt Bevin won at about 30%. The Secretary of State's office says that turnout in this election was about 42%. When you look at the map, what Andy Beshear was able to do was he was able to flip certain counties that Bevin had won, particularly in northern Kentucky, eastern and central Kentucky. But he also was able to have massive victories in Louisville and Lexington, mm-hmm. Kentucky's two Democratic strongholds and two largest cities. For example, Jack Conway, the Democratic nominee in 2015, he won Lexington, where the University of Kentucky is located. He won that over Matt Bevin by about 10,000 votes in 2015. Andy Beshear beat Bevin by 36,000. In Louisville, Conway won about 37,000 votes. Beshear beat Bevin in Louisville by about 100,000 votes.
Yeah, so Philip Bailey, hang on for a second because I want to explore that more when we come back from a quick break. We're talking about whether there's now a porous boundary between national and local politics. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunha was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country, but it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the very fascinating elections that happened yesterday in Kentucky, Mississippi, and Virginia, and what they tell us about whether there's a more porous boundary than ever between national and local politics. Find us online at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've got lots of comments coming in here. For example, Mark788 says, elections at the state and local level will be a referendum on Trump if the candidates and the state and local parties make it one. Someone else calling themselves Doc says, as someone who lives in Kentucky, I can tell you that the gubernatorial race was not about Trump. It was about voting out a bad governor who angered teachers and the many citizens they served. So let's listen a little bit to what Democrat Andy Beshear told a crowd of his supporters last night as he claimed victory in the Kentucky gubernatorial race.
It's a message that says our elections don't have to be about right versus left. They are still about right versus wrong.
And Beshear went out of his way not to mention President Donald Trump, but as we've been discussing, the president had actually rallied in Lexington earlier this week in support of Republican candidate Governor Matt Bevin. And here's what the president said earlier in Kentucky.
If you lose, it sends a really bad message. It just sends a bad, and they will build it up. Here's the story. If you win, they're going to make it like ho-hum. And if you lose, they're going to say Trump suffered the greatest defeat in the history of the world. This was the greatest. You can't let that happen to me.
President Trump in Lexington, Kentucky on Monday. Let's go to Sean, who's calling from Richmond, Kentucky. Sean, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. I just wanted to mention that I believe that the Bevin-Bashir election really did come down to local issues. But I do wonder what implications this has for 2020 based on the turnout in the suburban and metro, Lexington, Louisville, and the Cincinnati area. And I'll take my comment off the air.
Sean, thank you for your call. Philip Bailey, this is what you were getting to before the break. But go ahead and give us some more analysis on this, on the suburban-urban rural divide in Kentucky.
Right. I mean, let's look at northern Kentucky, Boone County, Kenton County, Campbell County, the Cincinnati suburbs. Back in 2009, 2010, this was the headquarters of the burgeoning Tea Party movement here in Kentucky. Matt Bevin won it decisively in 2015. Two of those three counties, however, Kenton and Campbell, went for Bashir. And in Campbell County in particular, it wasn't even close. Bashir won pretty convincingly, I believe, by more than 10 points. The caller from Richmond is correct. I mean, the Bashir campaign kept this completely focused on local issues. And I think what you have seen is the question of, particularly for suburban voters, were they fed up? Were they disturbed by Governor Bevin's, some of his behavior? I spoke with Representative Jerry Miller, State Representative Jerry Miller, out of Louisville, a Republican, for my column in the Courier-Journal a few weeks ago, months ago. And he told me on the record, said, look, a lot of Republicans in the legislature, we like Governor Bevin's policies. We like him signing right-to-work legislation, charter schools, his advocacy for school choice, his anti-abortion views, et cetera, et cetera. But he said, admittedly, many Republicans within the legislature don't like and have a problem with some of his behavior on social media, particularly him attacking Kentucky judges, saying that they're hacks, right? Like, so many of them admitted that there was a problem there. Even Senate President Robert Stiver said last night as the election results were coming in that if this is about policies, then conservatives will show up. If it's about personality, many of them may stay home. It was a perfect storm, right? I mean, for Andy Bashir, who had a name recognition from his father, from Paducah to Pikeville, end to end of both sides of the state, Governor Bevin, certainly unpopular amongst his own party and Kentuckians, particularly teachers who are a very civically engaged, connected group of people.
Right.
In some of these counties, the school board, the school, is the largest employer. All people know Miss Merriweather, right, in their local school. They taught their children, their parents, their grandparents. And Governor Bevin insulting these folks and calling them names and pointing the finger at them when he was trying to overhaul the pension system got in the way of some of his own accomplishments. Mm-hmm. His administration, for example, fully funded the pension system while he was in office.
Wow. So Philip, just briefly, did impeachment come up or the impeachment inquiry come up at all during the campaign?
Certainly Governor Bevin tried to insert that, as I stated earlier, but he would say, look, this is what constituents are asking me about, telling me about, right?
Yeah.
That was something that certainly the Bevin campaign wanted to make it about. But I don't know if you heard many average Kentuckians who were even plugged into this race, the first thing on their mind didn't seem to be impeachment.
Yeah. Okay. So Kara Ong-Whaley, let me turn back to you there.
Yes.
Kara is the associate director of the James Madison Center for Civic Engagement at James Madison University in Harrisburg, Virginia. Harrisonburg, I should say, Virginia. We're going to get back to the specifics of Virginia here in a second. But Kara, I was wondering if you could reflect with me on what Philip just said, because, pushing back against the impeachment inquiry is a strong galvanizing force, I imagine, for the GOP base. But are we seeing it in Kentucky that it also has its limits because you can't overcome the importance of these local issues? And granted, in Kentucky, you had kind of a unique situation because, as Philip's been telling us, just Bevin was so wildly unpopular. So I'm just wondering what we can read from that.
I think we can read very little from it, yeah. right? I think he's an outlier rather than the norm for what, you know, in terms of implications for 2020 or and just what we're seeing more broadly, just because of because of the state of the country in terms of the sorting that we've seen and the realignments of the party coalitions over the last couple of decades. So that we do because we do have these urban, rural and suburban divides geographically speaking, we have different, you know, regional realignments that have occurred. And then, you know, the coalitions of the parties have changed so that, you know, the Republican Party tends to be whiter, older, and male, and the Democratic Party has a more diverse coalition, and we have wider gender gaps. So I think, you know, some of these national trends are also affecting the state elections, and that those are going to play more of a role. And so what it means for these state and local elections is it's much harder for an individual to break through some of these broader national trends that have been occurring. Another, you know, important factor in all of this is if we look at the party system and the nationalization of the parties, which has weakened the state and local parties. If you look at state party platforms, they look a lot more like the national platforms than they once did, especially if we think back to the 1800s, where local parties were very vibrant and based on patronage, and there was much more local connection, and local issues meant a lot more in the local party platforms. And then we also have to think about campaign fundraising and spending as well. If you look at the races in Kentucky and Virginia, you had a lot more outside spending in those races, and you had you had a lot of money from the party committees flowing in. And some of the major, you know, industries like healthcare, education, for example, playing a big role, as well as issue-based funders, you know, both in the states, but also, you know, outside funding coming from beyond those states into the elections. So there are a lot of forces that I think converged on, you know, the local scene, some national forces, you know, that converged to drive some of these local elections. At the same time, you know, it does matter, you know, when I think one commenter noted, if you make it about a particular issue, then that's what is going to drive people to the polls. And so I think, you know, one of the things that what we need to see more of is increased capacity for local organizations to actually be able to engage residents and voters on the issues so that they can participate. And we also, you know, there's also sort of structural barriers, right, different abilities across states to participate right. in the process.
Oh, this is absolutely fascinating. Okay, so let's go back to our callers. Let's go to Patricia, who's calling from Chester, Virginia. Patricia, you're on the air.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I typically lean Republican, but I vote on the issues and the quality of the candidate. And because of the inappropriate behavior and the repeated poor judgment in the Oval Office, combined with the unwillingness of congressional leadership to challenge you in the executive branch, I felt it left me with no choice but to make a statement at the poll. So for the first time in many years, I went with a straight blue vote.
Wow. Okay. Well, and Patricia, I mean, it sounds like you wish you would have had another option, though.
Absolutely. I'm very disappointed in the extreme polarization of really both parties. And I felt that this was my only chance to make a statement.
Well, and so I'm hearing you talk about you cast your vote with this national lens in mind. But as Kara Onwuele was telling us earlier, now with Democratic control of the Virginia state legislature, that could bring about a lot of statewide policy changes in Virginia. You okay with that?
I think that might be something that'll get attention. I think that's what has to happen.
Okay. And attention in a good or a bad way, I'm curious.
Well, just in terms of the fact that I do view this vote as a referendum on what's going on in D.C. So I'm hoping that lawmakers' attention will be called to that. And what I would eventually like to see happen is things go to more bipartisan cooperation, you know, so that we're not so polarized as a nation and so that we can accomplish things.
Well, Patricia, thank you so very much for your call. Kara, you want to respond to what you heard Patricia say?
Yeah, I mean, I think she's, you know, there are many voters like her, you know, and but again, I want to think about the civic and political participation gap. Mm-hmm. And again, who actually participates in these elections. And essentially, we know that in state and local elections, the electorate tends to be older, more wealthy, and whiter, right? But when, you know, more voters are, when we reach out to additional people, when we make sure that they are able to participate in the process, that actually increases their representation. And so I think that's also important to be thinking about in terms of these state and local elections is, you know, how do we increase participation and address some of the structural barriers to participation?
Okay, let's go to David, who's calling from Frankfort, Kentucky. David, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. This was, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, this was for me, and I know a lot of us, a referendum on Obamacare. We signed up more Kentuckians during what we called Connect, that was our version, than any other state in the union. And then Bevin went on this, you know, vendetta and completely dismantled it and tried to kick about 400,000 of us off of Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
His work rules, you have to understand, are so draconian that even the workers don't understand, the social workers don't understand them.
Yeah.
So they're specifically designed to force people to lose their Medicaid, be locked out, and never come back.
David, thank you so much for your call. So Philip Bailey, we hear this over and over again from folks that they are voting on health care.
Right. In Kentucky... and the caller is absolutely correct. The Connect, that the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, whatever you wanted to call it, was very popular here in the state of Kentucky, particularly if you called it the Affordable Care Act and not Obamacare. And one thing that Governor Bevin had said was that he was petitioning for a work requirement on, quote, able-bodied Medicaid recipients. And his philosophy was, look, folks who get these benefits – if they're able to, they should be working. They should be volunteering. They should be doing something for the benefits that they're receiving. That was, again, infused by the Beshear campaign saying and really I think energized the Democratic base, the liberal base that was really at the start and the core of his candidacy. And what Governor Bevin essentially said was that if I don't get my way on this, if the federal government does not allow me to impose these work requirements, I am going to cancel and get rid of the Medicaid expansion that my predecessor, Steve Beshear, put through, which would have jeopardized the health care for about 500,000 Kentuckians. So there's all these sorts of things that are at play here, all different parts of it. It was the perfect storm in a state that is leaning more conservative. Mm-hmm. State Democrats have always believed and thought that these off-year elections have inoculated them from the more liberal, progressive, national Democratic Party. Republicans have been able to pierce that as of late. For various reasons, again, like demographics is the issue. Kentucky is an overwhelmingly white rural state outside of particularly Louisville and Lexington. But what I think Andy Beshear was able to do, he was able to merge the policy concerns that progressives and even moderate folks had about Governor Bevin's attempts to change the healthcare system, education, etc., and also merge disaffected Republicans and others who just did not like this governor's personality into one.
Yeah.
And unlike National Democrats, he was not being radicalized by President Trump, which, like you're seeing for Democrats at the national level.
I see. Okay, so we've just got a couple of seconds left here, and I want to ask both you, Philip, and Kara, one last question here. So, Philip, first to you. Do you care to hazard a guess on what window this might give us onto Mitch McConnell's reelection prospects?
Senator McConnell is not concerned or sweating at all this issue. He feels that his people feel this was a very much a referendum on Matt Bevin, for example. Their protege, Senator McConnell's protege, Daniel Cameron, won the attorney general's race, the first Republican attorney general since World War II, the first African-American attorney general. And another McConnell protege, Michael Adams, won Secretary of State against the very popular, very well-known Heather French Henry, former Miss America in 2000.
Okay. And Kara Ong Whaley, last question to you here. Again, just help us look forward here. What is the lesson that we ought to be taking about sort of the porous boundary between national and local politics as we look forward to 2020? We just got about 30 seconds.
We really have to be figuring out what matters in people's lives and what are the issues that they care about and working towards addressing those. I think there's been a pretty big disconnect between addressing people's needs and getting things done in governance. And so I think the question is, you know, who are the candidates who can best address those needs?
Well, Kara Ong Whaley is Associate Director at the James Madison Center for Civic Engagement at James Madison University, joining us from Harrisonburg, Virginia. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Philip Bailey, political reporter at the Louisville Courier-Journal, speaking to us from Louisville, Kentucky. Philip, it was great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from Sharif Campbell, Celeste Katz-Marston, Jeffrey Lyne, Wes Martin, and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.